Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show by dialing 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, my friend and co-host Susan Murphy Milano has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her site at www.conqueringcancer.me. Kim Colton's manning the switchboard tonight. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Denny. Nice to be here tonight.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Kim. And our guest tonight is Deborah Gauthier, author of Bright Lights, Dark Places. She was one of the first female patrol officers hired under the same standards as men on the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. She spent 21 years on the force, leaving it in 2001. During her tenure, she faced down suspects who were high on PCP, high-speed chases into oncoming traffic, and used her martial arts skills to subdue burly men. But not all of Deborah's battles while working as a police officer were with criminals. She sometimes faced discrimination in the male-dominated profession, suffering demotions, unsafe working conditions when other officers would not provide backup. Deborah, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Before we get started, Deborah, I wanted to just mention that back, I think it was probably 1995 or possibly 1996, I went through the Las Vegas Metro Citizens Academy and did a ride-along with the Southeast Area Command. And I hadn't been in a patrol car in several years, and we ended up with a couple of emergency calls on that shift. I think we were on like a 7 at night to 3 in the morning shift, some hours like that. And I remember what an adrenaline rush I got when we were on Maryland Parkway and we had to go into the oncoming lane to get by a traffic jam. And I was it was a night I won't forget soon. It was really exciting. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah, it really brought back some memories. And I had a great time that night. It was a great crew I was working with. So I really enjoyed it. At any rate, let's talk a little bit about, I want to talk about your career with Metro, but before that, before we get into that, you, at I believe the age of 18, had a scholarship to go to Arizona State University, and then something happened to you would you tell us what happened when you were 18?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to encourage your co-host, Susan, that she can beat that cancer. I've already fought that battle. And what happened was that summer, as I was getting ready to go to Arizona State University on a full-ride scholarship for diving, we were preparing to go to a diving meet in Southern California. My coach spotted a mole on the middle of my back, and he told me to go have it checked. And I'm just, you know, I'm 18 years old, probably in the top shape of my life. I just looked at my coach and said, Coach, I'll take care of it when I get back. You know, thank God that he had spotted that, Denny, because it was at a place in the middle of my back where I would have never seen it. So I went to a dermatologist the week before we left, and the doctor called my mother and I the very next day, and he said, you know, I want you in my office. And when I went to the doctor's office with my mom, he just sat across the desk, and he was looking, you know, very concerned, and he said, you know, I've got some bad news. You've got you've been diagnosed with malignant melanoma, the advanced stages. So I was already in the advanced stages of that cancer, which they call the black widow of the cancers, because most people, before they discover they have it, it's already too late.
Wow.
Yeah, it was, and I was 18 years old. So, I mean, you can just imagine the devastation. And you know, you think when you're that young, you're pretty much invincible. And I had no idea what I was going to face that next year. I spent battling cancer, and I mean, it was rough.
And so, had you been older or not, possibly not in the condition you were in, maybe you wouldn't have beat it.
Absolutely. You know, I had the surgery. In fact, it was funny. I was put in the hospital here in Las Vegas. You know, this is my hometown. I grew up here at Sunrise Hospital. I'll never forget it. And it's one of the older hospitals here in Las Vegas. And I was sitting up in the windowsill looking at the traffic traveling by on Maryland Parkway, the area that you were patrolling, as a matter of fact, when you were in that Citizens Academy. I was sitting up in the windowsill watching the traffic go by with tears running down my face thinking, I'm too young to die. This is crazy. And I, you know, I don't really think I grasped the seriousness of it until, you know, I was actually in the hospital facing the treatment and the testing. So that night I snuck out of the hospital. I put my running shoes on and my running clothes, and I snuck down the stairwell, and I took off running out across the desert. And this is back in 1975, so it was pretty much all desert out here in Las Vegas, a very small town. But I was running across the desert, and I just kept running, and I just, it was like the faster and farther I could get, just running until I had nothing left. And it was like right before the sun was going down over the mountains, and I remember just falling to my knees and saying, God, if you'll spare my life, I'll do anything for you. And I will tell you, be careful when you make bargains with God. And number two, you know, when I got up off my knees, I realized I had a peace. You know, when I walked back to that hospital, I just felt like, okay, it's going to be okay. I just had that peace. But I will tell you, God called me on that bargain later on, because I had no desire nor any really plan to be a police officer at that point in my life.
And you, when did you get clear of, I mean, how long did the treatment process last, and when did you get a clean bill of health where you knew you were going to be okay?
Well, you know, they say any cancer like that, it's a seven-year period where they check you. And, you know, I had surgery that was very evasive. They took a section out of my back about the size of a basketball, and they had to go so deep. Yeah, they had to go through muscle. It was a very deep incision because of the stage of that cancer. They had to make sure they got all the cancer cells. So they really took a large section out of my back. And for follow-up, they recommended I have chemotherapy, and you know, and I just realized there's no way I want to do that. And so I did some research, and a friend of mine actually, her and her husband took me down to Mexico, and I went to a clinic, a detox clinic, for the follow-up treatment, and went through that unorthodox treatment. Back then, you know, that was pretty, it was not very popular, and so the oncologist told me, he said, you'll be dead in a year if you go down there and don't have the chemo. And I said, well, I'll take my chances. So I went down there, and when I came back, Denny, I weighed maybe 95 pounds. I looked like a prisoner of war. I was just skin. I just lost all my muscle, and, you know, because I went through, it's a very radical detoxing system. But they believe that cancer a lot of times is environmental, so they try to, you know, they just cleanse your body and let your body heal itself, because your body's actually designed to do that with the right environment and the help and assistance to do that. So I fought that cancer, went through that process for 6 weeks down in Mexico. Then I came back, and it was a matter of rebuilding and gaining my strength. But it took a good year to come back and be able to function and get moving on with life. So I literally took that year off school to battle cancer.
So thankfully your oncologist was wrong about taking the route of treatment that you took.
That's correct. That's why I want to encourage. Is it Susan, your co-host?
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to, Susan, if you're listening, I just want to encourage you in the midst of this that cancer is not a death sentence by any means. In fact, there are many of us who are survivors of that. So, and I will tell you, once you go through that, it actually, it's good for the body, because when you come back, I believe you come back stronger and healthier because you make some changes in your lifestyle that maybe other people don't do, take for granted, so to speak. So I'll be praying for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Ebra. I'm sure Susan appreciates that, and I do.
Absolutely.
Now, so after you missed out on your chance then for Arizona State, right, because of the cancer issue.
Yeah, I did, and that was heartbreaking because my family, my mom raised four kids by herself. She couldn't afford to send me to a school like that, so I ended up staying right here in Las Vegas and attending UNLV and working my way through school.
So then you said the cancer thing was 75-ish, so was it around 79 or 80 you saw an ad looking for a few good men?
Yeah, you know, and that's where I knew that, you know, I didn't have that even desire or idea to think about being a police officer. But when I saw that ad, Denny, something kind of, it got me riled inside. First of all, they were looking for a few good men, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what, I can do that because I love a challenge. And then the second thing was I just realized that, you know, once you go through something like that, a battle really for your life, that I wanted my life to make a difference. I knew I wanted to do something with my life that would help other people. So when I saw that ad, I just knew there was something in me that just said, you know, that's what you're meant to do. And so I answered that ad.
And what was the process like from the time you answered the ad until what happened next? Did you get called in for an exam, or what was the process to get into the academy?
Well, it's a lengthy process. In fact, the first phase of the testing, there was like four or five different phases of it to just make the cut. And, gosh, there may have been 8 to 1,200 applicants that applied for the position. And the first part of the testing was the written exam. So we went out and took the written exam. You had to make a certain percentile to make the next cut. So I was in the upper 90s, so they called me for the second phase of the training, which was to run an obstacle course. And that's a funny story. I actually ran from my house out to the obstacle course because back then I was running long distance. So I just figured, you know what, I'll turn this into a training run. I'll just run out to the course. It was maybe 4 or 5 miles from my house. I'll just run out there, run the obstacle course, and then run home, and that'll be a long training day for me. So I ran out there, and when I showed up, there were probably, I don't know, 100 guys gathered around waiting to go run this course. And it was the old days. Now, remember, it was the same standards as the men, so there was nothing to accommodate for my size or my gender. I had to take the same exact test as the men and just finish in the amount of time that we were given. So we had to run this course, and it was about a size of a football field and had all these obstacles on it. The first one was a 6-foot block wall, and they had a drainage pipe you had to crawl through. So you had to navigate this course and make it under 100 seconds, which was quite fast. So I ran the course, and when the guy announced my time of 86 seconds, there was a hush over the crowd because these guys were looking at me. First of all, running up to the course, which probably wasn't a wise thing to do, drawing attention to myself like that, and then to run home. But, you know, on my way home, a car came up beside me as I was running, and it slowed down, and I look over, and it's this older guy, and, you know, he's got like this polyester powder blue leisure suit on, and he's got a cigar in his mouth. He looks over at me, and he rolls down the window really slow as I'm running, and he says, are you one of them there marathon runners? And I'm looking at the guy like, who is this guy, you know? Little did I know, I just ignored him, but little did I know he was the director of personnel. So he went back to the department and told everybody this female marathon runner was going to be in the police academy. So that was my debut. Yeah, it was crazy.
I'm assuming that probably there weren't all that many females among these 800 or 1,200 or whatever applicants? Were there a relatively small number of women who had applied?
Yeah, it was a small number. In fact, out of all of those applicants, once we went through the physical agility, the oral board, the psychological testing, and then the actual medical exam, 50 recruits were chosen. So you had to be the top 50. And out of those 50 police recruits, there were five that were women, including myself.
All right.
So that started the – go ahead.
I was going to say, now, at that point in time, were there a lot of female officers working the streets, or were there relatively few?
Gosh, you know, there was – I don't think there were any on the streets when I joined. The year before I hired on, a gal had applied, and they had a height and weight requirement. So she didn't make that and filed a complaint with the Department of Justice, and that's why I was able to test – under the same standards, because they lift that requirement. Otherwise, it would have not made it. It was, I think, you had to be 5'8", 160, something like that. So I would have not even been eligible to test. So before me, there were a few women that had been grandfathered into positions that worked like sexual assault or juvenile detective. So there were traditional women's jobs and roles that those gals worked at. And, you know, but taking nothing away from these women, because they are truly pioneers. That's why I don't say I'm the very first woman, because there were other women before me, not very many, Denny, maybe, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen. But they, it was tough, and back then they didn't, you know, they weren't really able to earn the respect, because there were, they just weren't allowed to work, you know, the front lines and do certain jobs as I was able to do, because the standards had changed.
Deborah, let me just take a second to inform our listeners, if they're not familiar with Las Vegas Metro, when you applied and went to the academy, Metro as an entity was fairly new. Metro was actually established in 1973, I believe, when the Las Vegas City Police Department and the Clark County Sheriff consolidated to form Las Vegas Metro. So there were people, you know, in Metro at that time who, like you said, were grandfathered in, who had been with the two agencies, the Las Vegas City and Clark County, and then they were all incorporated into Metro.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, So you were with, and in the great scheme of things, a 6 or 7 year old department is almost an infant.
Yeah, pretty much. You're right.
Now, you say that there were 50 candidates selected to actually go to the academy, the five women including you. What was the reaction at that point, at that early stage, the academy stage, of your male recruits, your colleagues? Were you kind of accepted, or were the women a joke to them, or how were you treated or looked at by the men?
You know, it was a mixed review. I mean, there were a few guys that, you know, they just kept quiet and to themselves, and they were not, you know, it didn't matter to them either way. They were just there to make it through, and if you could cut the course and make it with them, then they were okay with that. But there was a small group of men that were not like that, and they were very disrespectful, dishonoring. And I remember when we were in inspection one time, one of the recruits whistled at me as I walked down the hallway, and the sergeant found out about it, and or heard it, actually, and he jumped all over this guy. But the guys, I mean, the academy staff, even the sergeant, he just looked at me and he said, "You better be, you know," not exactly a nice way to say it, but he goes, "You better be all that and a bag of chips, because I don't believe women belong here." So, you know, they were tough. It was a rough road. The academy, we washed out over 50% of the class. It was psychologically intense and physically demanding. Academics, you had to fulfill all the requirements. It was a 4-month academy that we went through, and so it was tough. they, you know, one of the things they did, which was really interesting, is they had this this procedure they did, this process when a recruit was going to wash out. They had an aquarium that contained a boa constrictor, this big snake, and they would bring this this glass aquarium in with Dr. Doom. That's, they named the snake Dr. Doom, and then they had a cage full of mice that had each one of our numbers on it. So the mice equaled each one of the recruits. And when someone was going to wash out, a black hand would drop down in the glass between the office, academy office, and our classroom. So we knew someone was going to wash out. We didn't know who. And then the staff would come in, marched in formation with Dr. Doom, put him on the desk, and then drop one of the little mice into the aquarium. And we would have to sit there for however long it took till Dr. Doom grabbed his prey and swallowed this mouse whole. And I mean, you'd literally be sitting there with sweat running down your face going, oh my God, is this me? And just to watch the trauma of this little mite, you know, shaking in the glass, and you're thinking, oh my God. And then they would come in as soon as Dr. Doom got his prey and snatch your someone's, you know, desk, their books off their desk, and march you out. And you'd see that recruit later on walking down the hall in tears because they had washed out of the academy. It was intense.
You know, I must say that my first nonfiction book was called Policing Las Vegas, and it was a history of law enforcement in Southern Nevada, and I went through the two different agencies, then into Metro. And there's a newscaster, and I believe she's still active in Las Vegas, named Nina Raditich.
Oh, I remember her, yeah.
Yeah, she went. I don't know just how they worked this, but she, through her job as a TV anchor, she was allowed to attend the academy, and she went through. She was treated basically the same as a regular recruit, and she didn't get any special treatment. And when I interviewed her and did a piece in that book about her experience, she said that she learned an awful lot. But she said it was the most stressful, and that's the only time she remembers job-related of actually crying, because she said it was just, like you say, intense. She had a different term, it was something, and she said it strengthened her a lot. For one thing, she said she always had the habit of being late. She was late the first day, and that was the end of that. She said,
"Well, after that, yeah."
Yeah, taught her punctuality. But that was a four month academy, huh?
It was. We graduated 21 Metro officers out of the 50 that began. So I was the only female to make it.
So your other four female colleagues didn't survive.
Correct.
Dr. Doom had his way, huh?
Yeah, Dr. Doom took a toll. You know, so we lost a lot just by resigning. You know, because of the pressure and just the things that you were going to have to go through, you know, quite a few just quit. They said, I've had enough, walk out. So it was, you know, we had military vets, you know, Vietnam vets in there that they said, you know, I didn't put up with this in the military. This is crazy. But, you know, I can understand why you go through that now in hindsight, you know, doing 21 years on the police department, working primarily on the streets, both as an officer and later as a sergeant lieutenant, that, you know, you really do face a lot of pressure and responsibility when you're out there doing the job. And I know we like to Monday morning quarterback and critique all of these forced situations when officers have to take a life. But I'll tell you, it's a lot of pressure on a young person. And so you do need that training and that breaking period when you're broken and then you're built back up. It's like being in the military. It's like going out to battle really on the streets and just being prepared mentally for what you're going to face in a shift.
Now when you graduated and your class graduated from the academy, were you immediately given assigned to an area command, or did you get some time off, or how did that work once the academy was over with?
Boy, that would have been nice. No, as soon as we finished the academy training, we went right into field training where we assigned out on patrol with a training officer. Now, I was fortunate because I was the girl cop, and they thought, okay, we're going to watch her fail out here on the street, because academically I did really well. I came in, I think I was number 7 in my class academically. So, and it was, there's practical and the firearms and the physical training, all of that composed your comprised your final score. But when I went out on the street, they're like, okay, well, you know, what's she going to do in a fight, sort of a thing. So they were so concerned about me, they gave me really senior training officers, which was really beneficial because these guys had a lot of street experience and knowledge. So I just gleaned from them, even though they were hard guys. I mean, I'll tell you, my first training officer, and I'll just say his name's Ed. If he's listening, that's great, because he's a friend of mine. He's a good guy. He was my very first training officer. But when they assigned me to patrol, you know, the training sergeant came in to conduct the briefing and introduce the trainees, the recruits to the training officers. So when he introduced me to Ed, Ed got up and walked out and left me sitting in the briefing room. So, you know, I mean, I did what any rookie would do. I followed the guy out, and, you know, he didn't talk to me the whole week. The first week he didn't say anything other than to get us on the 42 list, and you know that's the police code for lunch break because this guy just loved to eat. So as far as he was concerned, police work didn't start until after dinner. But it was funny because the second week, so I just sat there and took it, and, you know, I kept quiet, and I just, you know, was observant and learned as much as I could that first week. The second week, I was really surprised, Denny, when Ed threw the keys to the police vehicle at me. Well, I was in heaven, and from that point on, I was looking for my first bad guy. And so you would know that that very second week, I didn't have to wait long. A Hell's Angel went by us flying his colors. So I got behind the guy, turned my red lights on, and he took off. And I did what any rookie would do. I chased him. So here I am flying down Tropicana with red lights flashing and siren blaring, and I'm so focused on this guy. We're hitting probably speeds up to 100 miles an hour. This guy's on a Harley. And I look over, I didn't even notice, but I looked at Ed, and he was sitting next to me in a state of shock, Denny. The color had gone out of his face. The poor guy was hanging on for dear life. I don't think he'd ever driven in the car with somebody like that before. But anyway, the guy finally pulled over, and before I could get out of the car, Ed grabs his ticket book and starts beating me with it. And he goes, "Don't ever drive like that with me in the car again, rookie." So, I mean, I just ignored him, jumped out of my car, and took custody of the guy. But, you know, it was just... I was really just wired for the work, and, you know, and that was another 4 months of training, and they had I had 4 training officers, and after that I was assigned my first patrol station.
Now, Deborah, this Hell's Angel guy. Now, this I imagine you were pretty wired, you know, with the pursuit and so forth, and then getting the ticket book across the head from that. Did the suspect give you a hard time at all? I mean, was there any issues like, oh boy, this is a broad, she's not going to arrest me type thing, or was he pretty compliant?
You know, you would think that would be the case, but it wasn't, because I was so wired. I jumped out of the car. I mean, I was so aggressive. I mean, I just went after the guy, you know, and took him into custody, and they train you really well. I'll just tell you, it doesn't matter how big you are. I'm only 5'3", maybe, I don't know, 110 pounds back then. So, I mean, I'm small in stature, but when I just was out there to do business and, you know, I was pumped with adrenaline. So even if the guy would have done anything crazy, I would have just pounced on him because I was just, you know, I was just pumped all up. And so, yeah, I didn't have any issues with him at all. I mean, I took him into custody, and I think he was really surprised that I chased him and, you know, caught up to him. And I never had any really issues out on the street. I mean, I treated people with respect, and, you know, because most of my suspects were all larger than I am, I was always smart in the way I worked around people, and I didn't take unnecessary risks. And as you know, women are naturally good communicators and negotiators, so we really are effective as police officers.
The whole process now, so you've been between the academy and now you're training, riding with a field training officer. you've been right about 8 months now on the job, right, roughly?
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, so now you get your first, now you're done with your field training, you're done with the academy, done with field training. What? Where were you assigned on your first actual duty station?
Oh, my gosh. It was the downtown area command. And these were the guys, when they merged the city and county, most of these were the old city cops. So they had, like, animosity between, you know, there was all this friction between the county sheriffs and the city police officers. You know, there was, you know, they had their little cliques and their little areas. Well, that's where I was assigned, and it was the old city hall underground. That's where the substation was. And these guys were all pretty, they were a rough crowd. I worked the swing shift, the same shift that you went out on patrol on. That's the 3 p.m. till 1 a.m. in the morning, so it's that mid shift. And I worked around these guys, and I'll tell you, the very first night I walked in there for my shift, I was walking down the hallway, and as I'm walking down the hallway, I look down the hall, and here's a guy, stark naked, Denny, walking from the shower room to the locker room. I guess there was a hallway between. He had his towel on his arm, and he was walking naked. I just looked at him, and he looked at me, and I think we were both in shock at that point. But they just didn't have women back then, so they were like, what the heck? And, you know, they were like, you know, they were looking at me like, oh, what's she going to do in a fight? So it was rough. And when I walked in that briefing room the first night, I don't know if you remember this, but, I mean, it was so smoke-filled, you couldn't even see your hand in front of you. I mean, everybody was smoking back in the day. And so these were the old-timers. And, you know, I walked up to get my briefing, my hot sheet. You know, it's got all the crimes on it for the night. So you pick that up so you have, you know, you scan it and you go over so you know what kind of a strategy of how you're going to, what you're going to be looking for on patrol that night. And when I walked up there to get my hot sheet, there was two sergeants sitting up there, my sergeant and another sergeant, and then there was a lieutenant. And he had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And the sergeant, who was not my sergeant, looked over at me when I picked up my hot sheet, and he said, hey, I'd tell you a joke that'd knock your, I'll just say, breasts off. And then he goes, but I see you've already heard it. So all these guys start cracking up, break out in laughter, and I'm totally red-faced. I'm like, oh, my God, what did I get myself into? But I walked back. I sat in the very back, tried to be invisible. But it was, I mean, that's kind of the, you know, that was the atmosphere I was working in. They, you know, this was before all the laws and, you know, sexual this, harassment, hostile work environment. That was before all those, that even came about. I mean, I was just in this, trying to survive, and I knew I didn't want to tick anybody off because these are my back out on the street, you know, my backup. So I knew I needed these guys to at least tolerate me and back me up if I needed it. So I didn't want to make any waves at that point. But, you know, that was kind of the atmosphere I walked into. And that very first week, I'm out on the patrol, and my sergeant, and he's a good friend of mine today, Tom. He was my first sergeant. The guy was a 6'6" motor cop. He was a motorcycle officer who got promoted while I was in the academy. Well, I got assigned to his squad. So he told me later, he said, Deborah, I was so concerned with your welfare, I didn't know where to assign you, so I put you in the very corner of our area thinking that you won't get hurt out there because there's not much going on. Well, what he didn't realize was my area bordered North Las Vegas, so all the bad guys went through my area at night to get home, and we worked the night shift. Yeah, so I'm on patrol that first week, and I'm just taking one last slow patrol through it was a convenience store. It's right over at Owens and Eastern, if you're familiar with that area in the northeast part of Las Vegas. Kind of a...
Yes.
Yeah, back in the day, it was kind of a rough area. But anyway, I was driving through this convenience store, this gas station, a convenience store right there on the corner, and there was an Albertsons park, you know, with a big parking lot. Well, I drove through, and as I'm driving through, here comes the clerk from the convenience store running out at me. He's limping, holding his leg, and pointing at this Oldsmobile that's taking off now at a high rate of speed. Well, I had just driven up on a robbery in progress. A cop's dream, Denny. So I took off after these guys. And, I mean, I didn't have time to do an interview. I just took off because they were leaving. So I caught them at the red light at Owens and Eastern. I got on the radio to tell the dispatcher what I had, give a license plate. And before I could do anything, they took off through the red light, and I was in hot pursuit. So get this. Here I am chasing these guys. I call a code red. I'm trying to give my direction of travel. Now, I have crossed over from my jurisdiction into North Las Vegas, so now I'm in another jurisdiction with no backup because this was late at night, like 12:30 at night before my shift ended, so the graveyard guys weren't really fully out there yet, and my guys had all gone into the station. So here I am chasing this guy, these two guys in this Oldsmobile, high rate of speed. I'm trying to catch the streets as I'm going by because I'm in another jurisdiction, so I haven't memorized these streets. And as I'm heading down Lake Mead westbound, we head over to the projects. And as I'm going along on this pursuit, code red means emergency traffic only. Well, guess who kept cutting into my traffic? You're not supposed to break a code red, because when there's a code red on the radio, and if anybody out there has ever listened to a scanner, there'll be this long, silent beep. Like a beep and then a silence. That's a code red. That means an officer's in a critical situation and no one is to break that code red. Everybody's just to go to that to the location and back them up. So, well, in my case, the lieutenant was so concerned that the girl cop was out there actually chasing bad guys. He kept coming on the air and breaking the code red and saying, "What's the nature of this pursuit?" You know, he wanted all the details, and I'm like, I don't have any idea. You know, I'm just trying to figure out where I'm at. Well,
yeah.
You know, here's the scary part. He covered my last transmission as I was going to give my location. These guys, I came around the corner, and they had spun the car out. So I was going to give my location. He covered my transmission, so nobody knew where I was. I slide up. You know, lock up the brakes, slide almost into these guys, broadside them. I've got the driver's side, facing me. And I jump out of my police car, and I grab my Remington 870 shotgun, which is about the size that I was, and I rack around in the chamber, and I point the barrel at these guys. And I'll tell you, it was like the deer in the headlights. Their hands were up, and nobody was moving. Because here's this white woman with a gun, you know, and I'm over in the project. Now, the good news is, The good news is that I left my siren on.
Uh-huh.
And the bad news is I left my siren on. The good news is that siren actually led my backup to my location because it was blaring. I didn't have time to turn it off. The bad news was that everybody in the projects had now, you know, come outside to find out what was going on. I was surrounded, and they were like, "Where's your backup?" You know, and it was intense. I mean, they could have taken over. It was a hostile crowd. You know, I was in the projects by myself, and we didn't have backup offs, or we didn't ride two-man units. We ride solo here in Las Vegas unless you're a training squad. So it was an intense moment, but I will tell you this. Not only had they robbed the convenience store, but they were in a stolen vehicle. So when my sergeant came up, he was my first unit to back me up. You know, we threw the guys in the car, towed the car, and ended up taking them to jail. I'll tell you, the next day at briefing, I didn't get any of that harassment like that first week. They weren't anymore, you know, saying, "Okay, what's she going to do in a fight?" They were slapping me on the back saying, "Hey, good job, rookie." And that really was the way my career went. I mean, that set the tone for my career. I knew that being the pioneer, the woman that would pave the way for other women coming up behind me, Denny, I didn't realize at the tender age of 21 that came with a price, and it would literally cost me everything. But I knew that I couldn't fail, that failure was not an option, and I had to go for it. In other words, I had to give 110% because it would pave the way for other women to be successful that would come behind me.
And so that night with the that arrest over in the projects, you more or less made your bones, right? I mean, you proved yourself, like you say, the next day with slaps on the back and not some of the other stuff.
Correct.
But you know, before we move on, Deborah, I just want to give Kim a chance, see if Kim has any questions. Kim, do you have anything you'd like to ask Deborah so far? Hello? She won't talk to either one of us.
I'm sorry. Yes, I do, Denny. We have Joe from Montana on the line, and he has a question about cold cases, and I'll let him ask the question, okay?
Go ahead.
Joe, you're on the air.
Okay. Don't sweat too much, Kim.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. This is my question. The reason why I came here, not so much for the thrust of the show tonight, but because you have in the tag cold case, and I wanted to find out from anybody, the guests that you have on the show tonight or anybody there, if you know about how two or three women, I forget if it's two or three, civilian women, how they solved and wrote a book about 23 cold cases, which they had solved, I thank you that all of them or the majority of them were murder cases. And I want to know if anybody knows about that, especially your guest.
Deborah?
So you're saying that these women wrote a book?
Yep.
And they were civilians on the police department?
No, they were just civilians.
Oh, civilians. Oh,
yeah,
okay, but they wrote about the...
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I have not heard about that. Do you have anything more, like a name or of the book? Or?
Well, I think it's probably Cold Cases is in the title of the book. But I wanted to find out your particular feelings about that, because as I was telling Kim, if 23 cases can be solved by women without subpoena power, why is it that the police force either didn't or couldn't do that on their own when they have badges, subpoena power, the power of the law behind them? Why do you figure that might be?
You know, that's really a tough one to answer because I'm not really familiar with, you know, times, dates, or, I mean, anything of any detail. I know there are unsolved cases. I know that when I was working I was working in the Detective Bureau at one time. We actually had a missing persons unit that I was able to set up, and we were looking at cold cases. So we would go back into the files and just look for any new evidence, anything that might have, you know, changed since the file was closed. So, but it's like anything else. It was all based on manpower needs. So we were fortunate because this was a brand new unit, and I was able to start it, and that was what we focused on. I know the homicide detectives and the other detectives, the caseloads that they carry are usually horrendous. And so there's limitations on, you know, how much they can do with time and all of that. So, but it's hard to answer that one. I would love to read the book and just see more and look into that because, you know, that's fascinating that they would be able to do that.
Deborah, may I take a shot too at this?
Absolutely. Sure.
And see if you agree. What my experience has been that, as Deborah indicated, manpower is an issue with all these agencies. I know that there are certain departments, I don't know if Las Vegas Metro does it, but some departments, because of manpower shortages, they are getting, on a volunteer basis, former police officers, former people with law enforcement experience, to come in as cold case units to try to take a look with a fresh set of eyes at some of these cold cases. So I know manpower with most agencies is an issue. Some, I think, try to get around it, possibly with relying on volunteers. Others maybe don't do that, and the cases just sit there. Another thing, I think, because I'm here on the show, we deal with a lot of cold cases, and I think depending on the agency, each agency is different in size, different in you know, in personnel. But I think that if the family of the victim, I'm talking now homicide cases, if the family of the victim isn't aggressive in some cases and doesn't keep calling that department or calling whoever their detective is or the chief or whoever on a fairly regular basis to keep the pressure on, if you will, asking for answers, asking what's been done, asking if something's going to be done, I think sometimes that those cases that don't get the attention from the family may not get the attention from the department. Does that make sense? Deborah, does it make sense to you?
That is a good point. Yes, it does.
And I, you know, again, I'm not familiar with what department the caller is talking about or what area geographically or anything, so I can't say that's there, but I have run into that, experienced that, and heard about the manpower issues. And perhaps that's what prompted some of these civilian ladies apparently to take the bull by the horns and become their own cold case squad.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, volunteers are being used more and more by police agencies. One of the things that made our unit very effective was a volunteer force, so to speak. We had it was a Metro Volunteer Program, we called it, and these were folks in the community that had, some of them owned horses that would go out and do searches when we had a missing person or a missing child. We would canvass the area, and these folks would be called, be on call, and I could mobilize a big squad of people to go out, because it's really all about eyes and ears and being witnesses and just digging in, and it's a community effort. I don't think really people understand that the police are really very dependent on a community that's proactive. In other words, that's calling in, like Denny says, that staying on top of things and offering information and working with the police in a partnership.
You can go to a site that's called citizensagainsthomicide.org.
Okay.
It's about these women. So,
oh, great. Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay.
All right.
I would have more questions, but Kim is sweating, so maybe I'll call
back.
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Great question.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Kim.
Yes, boss.
Deborah.
Yes.
Before we move on to the next question I have, well, I think it was 1992 is in my head right offhand for the Rodney King riots. Remember the Rodney King?
Oh, yes. Of course.
Now, you know what? I moved to Vegas in 1994, and I missed it, but I remember I watched on TV a lot of the coverage of the King riots,
yeah.
And I always associated them pretty much with L.A. I mean, that was in my head, that was where all the action was. I didn't realize, well, I did the Vegas Metro Police history, that Vegas had its hands full with those riots. Did you happen to, were you assigned to do any of that stuff or no? I know it was quite a session there in Vegas over the riots.
Absolutely. I was a sergeant out on patrol, so my squad was mobilized as other squads. I think all days off were called off. It was it was the same exact scenario as L.A. I mean, the folks in the community, in the African-American community here, burned down a shopping center, and they were just up in arms. They were going to be crossing over in mass, like a mob, over to the – they were trying to get downtown to the casinos. They were going to be just headed that way. So we had four-man units. We were taking rounds. People were shooting at us. You didn't know where these rounds were coming from. It was like a war, a street war. I remember we had flak jackets and helmets on because we were literally out there taking shots. One of the officers he wasn't on my squad, but he was on another squad, had his elbow out the car driving one of these four-man units, and someone shot him in the elbow, actually hit him in his elbow. We never could locate the shooter. Like I said, they were shooting at us from apartment buildings, from behind vehicles. We were taking shots, you know, all night long, and, you know, a good part of the neighborhood was being burned. It was on fire, so they were looting and just rioting in the streets. It was very intense. Luckily, fortunately, we didn't lose anybody. I don't think anyone was killed through all that. There were, you know, many that were injured, but it was a very intense time.
Yeah, I remember seeing pictures of armored personnel carriers brought in and stuff from what the National Guard or from the Army or whatever. Maybe it was from the air base, but I mean, it was like all I could think of was a regular combat zone. That's what it was.
It was. It was.
The other thing I wanted to ask, no talk about Las Vegas police history would be complete without talking about organized crime.
Right.
Thanks to the movie Casino and other movies, Vegas, I guess, will always have that tie, you know, that organized crime was part of Las Vegas. Did you have any encounters or any chance to get involved with or learn about what the organized crime was like during your tenure there?
Absolutely. In fact, I was working the streets. This would have been in the early 80s when they were still very active. And it was funny because in my patrol area, these guys used to go, they used to gather in my area at the Marie Callender's at night to have coffee and pie. So late at night, I would always be around the Marie Callender's because these guys were all, you know, they would all congregate there. And this was, you know, Frankie Rosenthal and Herbie Blitzstein, the Hole in the Wall Gang, Splotro, that group. So one night I was on patrol in that area, and sure enough, there was a huge explosion. I was only a few blocks away, and I was the very first unit to arrive on the scene. It was at the Marie Callender's. And in the parking lot with this smoldering vehicle that had been car bombed. And whoever set the car bomb didn't set it right, so when the bomb detonated, instead of blowing the mobster up, it blew him out of the car. So when I got there, the hood of that car was across this mall, this strip mall, and the guy who was in the car, the driver, was flopping around beside the car, and he was smoldering, and he was in shock, obviously. But I looked down, and sure enough, it was Frankie Rosenthal. They called him Lefty. And so I put up the yellow tape, and I was, you know, the reporters started arriving. But, yeah, those guys were active in my area. You know, we worked closely with the intelligence unit that gathered evidence, and they would surveil and you know, building cases on these guys. The way we got a lot of them off the streets and incarcerated was racketeering charges, where we put multiple charges on them. And I remember I worked a raid one night that was called Operation Chutzpah. And we went in early morning. This was a group of officers, intelligence officers, detectives, police officers, and our SWAT team actually did the entries on these mob guys' houses early in the morning. We started the raids like 4:30 in the morning when they were still asleep, and kicked the door, go in, and you know, we had warrants for their arrests. And the IRS, actually, their criminal team went with us. Those guys were more brutal than our team. They seized everything that wasn't, you know, tied down. They just took everything. But when it was funny because I arrested Herbie Blitzstein. So I took Herbie out in handcuffs, and somehow a journalist photographer had caught the picture. He took the photo of us with a telephoto lens of me, you know, this little 5'3" female walking this mobster out of the house, Herbie Blitzstein, in handcuffs. And that thing went across the AP wire. And my brother-in-law is an attorney in Chicago. He called me the next morning, and he said, "Deb, you humiliated the boy." And I'm just thinking, oh, great, because these are probably the mob, right? But, yeah, those guys were quite active during the day.
And let me just mention for the listeners who have seen the movie Casino, what Deborah was just talking about was I believe it's the opening scene of the movie. It starts with Lefty Rosenthal was portrayed, or his character was portrayed by Robert De Niro, and it starts showing De Niro flying through the air, kind of getting thrown out of the bombed car. So yes, that was quite a time in Vegas.
It was.
You know what, Deborah? We're already running out of time. What I'd like to ask you is this: if you would be willing to come back on another show, because we're never going to get through everything tonight, and I wanted to cover a couple of fairly short topics with you, would you be able to come back on within the next few weeks?
I certainly would, absolutely.
And we will finish up. I know we got a lot more to cover. If that's okay, I'll just ask you a couple of questions we can handle fairly quickly.
Very good.
Okay, well, one thing I was curious about, did you watch the pilot episode of Vegas, the new series based on Ralph Lamb? Ralph Lamb, it was a former sheriff. Our county sheriff and metro boss. Did you happen to catch the pilot episode?
I caught part of it, so I did tune into it. It was fun. The you know, Ralph was the sheriff before I came on. So I came in under Sheriff McCarthy. So Ralph Lamb had already gone. I had just heard the stories about this old sheriff that had been on, you know, had been there for years. And so, yeah, I caught part of it, but he was kind of a legend, so to speak, you know, on the police department.
Yeah, and I think I'll have to see how the rest of the, you know, the series goes, but I enjoyed that first episode anyway. It got off well. And you mentioned John McCarthy, and a little bit more of history for the listeners. McCarthy won election, I believe, in the November of 78. Took office in January 79, and at that time, Metro was having some issues. There had been a Metro Intel cop who'd been caught on FBI wiretaps providing information to some organized crime figures. And in fact, he was a fellow named named Joe Blasco, who's now deceased. But anyway, there were some issues between the feds and Metro, the lack of trust, if you will, and they weren't really cooperating all that much. And I remember Sheriff McCarthy ran on basically as a reform candidate to come in and get Metro's image back or restored to what it should be. And I really believe, based on my research, when Sheriff McCarthy took office, he made some controversial appointments. He appointed some guys from the ranks right up to bureau commander, and especially in the intelligence, he appointed a guy named Kent Clifford, who was a Vietnam combat vet, tough guy. And, I mean, that seemed to be a turning point to some degree in the law enforcement war or battle with the mob. Because after that, Metro and the feds started to cooperate again, and the relationship, I think, got restored. Is that kind of how you saw it being there during those years?
You know, I just came on in 1980. I was hired November of 1980, and then that first year I was in training. So he came to my graduation, and I shook his hand. I was fortunate to come on during that era. Like I said, the feds had lifted that ban on, you know, height and weight.
I think Deborah just dropped off the.
I think
Hopefully she'll call back. If not, Kim, why don't we see if we can schedule her, you know, to do a follow-up, even, and we'll finish up. There's a lot more we need to go over with Deborah to finish her story.
Oh, definitely.
And again, the title of the book is Bright Lights, Dark Places. The author is Deborah, that's D-E-B-R-A, Gauthier, G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R. I know that book is available on Amazon. I'm not sure what other outlets it might be at. But
Yeah,
this
she is
might
available
be her back
on Amazon.
Now.
Oh, here
this
she
should
is.
Be her on the line.
Donna?
Deborah?
Or, I mean, Deborah? I'm looking at the chat room. Deborah?
Oh, we lost it again.
She has a very bad connection. She has a very bad connection, so.
I was just getting into the wheelhouse, too, talking about the mob. It's my
I know.
And I wanted to get her her thoughts on the mob museum and stuff, but we'll save that for the next time.
Yeah, we'll have her on again for sure. Very interesting.
Did you have any comments or thoughts on what you heard so far?
I just think it's just wonderful. I mean, to hear her tell that story, and it turned out to be Lefty that was laying there next to the car, and she happened to come upon him like that. You know, it just, that is really, really something, I'll tell you.
It's amazing, and that that's another whole story, that Rodney King riots in Las Vegas. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I did the research. Like I said, I had thought everything was Los Angeles, and Vegas on a smaller scale, but the violence and everything was equal to what happened in L.A. Well, we're about out of time, so I'll wrap it up here, and I do promise we will have Deborah back on a future show.
Yes. Okay,
and I want to thank her for being on tonight. I also want to thank the Crime Wire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, October 9th. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. This is our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night. Good night, Kim.
Good night, Denny. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Deborah. Bye-bye.